Sure, whatever you want.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Good morning. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Rabbi Moskowitz. I have a rather, ambitious agenda this morning, so we'll get right to it. I'll try to share what I can share, and please jump in anytime, question, comments. Make sure, we're discussing communication, so I won't know that I've communicated properly unless I get some meaningful feedback and some questions. Okay. So when we talk about communication, the most basic form of communication is emotional. We're going to discuss mainly about what to say verbally, but just to understand how we connect with our children, how we connect with the spouse, with anybody who we come in contact with, there's an emotional basis for that communication. Very famous pasuk in Mishlei, kamayim hapanim lapanim kein lev adam la'adam. Just like a face reflects a face, the heart reflects the heart. What does that mean? The Gemara explains that the water that's reflecting a face, it's a mirror. When you look at a mirror, whatever expression you have on your face is reflected exactly. Yeah, you're smiling, there's a smile in the mirror. You're frowning, there's a frown in the mirror. You're closing one eye. Whatever you do, it's reflected exactly. So Shlomo HaMelech in Mishlei is telling us that exactly what you're putting out emotionally, whatever you feel in your heart, you're talking to somebody, you're interacting with somebody, whatever the feeling is in your heart that you're feeling towards that person at that moment, that is communicated on some level, and it's felt by the person, and they will receive whatever it is you're saying based upon that emotion. There's a very fascinating little story that took place way back when in Yerushalayim. Took place with Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, who was the Rav of the community, and he was a very strong advocate, shall we say, for maintaining traditions in the face of a lot of opposition. Things people wanted to change things, modernize things, bring different values to the community, and he was the one who stood up against it, and he therefore had faced tremendous opposition. So one day, apparently, he was sitting in his study. He was learning with some students. All of a sudden, a bunch of young Jewish men who were acting like thugs came in, and they were saying all sorts of terrible things to him, and they said they were going to kill him, and it was a very, very tense situation. So, as they tell the story, Zonnenfeld stood up very calmly, unbuttoned his shirt, and said, "If you want to kill me, go right ahead." He said, "But I'm not going to change my views. I'm not going to, whatever." Anyway, the way they tell the story is that they ran out of the door, and they left him alone. So his students said, you're a miracle worker. What happened?" He said, "It wasn't a miracle." He said, "These were wayward children from our community who went off the path and went someplace else. I filled my heart with love for them at this moment, and they couldn't resist that on whatever subconscious level." That was, that's how he explained what happened. So it's very real that even though we're not conscious of it, we don't realize it, but when one person conveys love to another person, or the opposite of feelings of anger and hatred, that is communicated and it's felt, and the response will be accordingly. So understand that. So that is to be understood, that the emotion, the nonverbal communication, is really the essence of how you connect to another person. That's obviously critical for parent-child relationship, same with the spouse, as we said, same as any other relationship that we have. Nevertheless, nevertheless, it's very important to verbalize your feelings, especially your feelings of love. You have to train yourself to say, I love you, to your child, even when they are doing the most ridiculous and annoying things and making you crazy. You might want to shout it at them and scream it at them or whatever it is, but let those words be come out of your mouth a lot. You have to be able to express verbally. So let's talk about verbal communication. Actually, the foundation of even of verbal communication is listening. Listening is what shows the other person that you care about them and that you have a connection to them. Somebody's talking, like if I'd be speaking now and you would all be on your phones, so that would communicate back to me that what I'm saying is not so important. Right? In a relationship, that could become pretty, you know, pretty damaging, potentially. On the other hand, if you show with eye contact, body language, that, you know, there's nothing else in the world more important than what I am saying to you right now, so that conveys, that communicates that feeling that, you know, you're important and what you're saying is important. And that, obviously, with children is, it's critical, it's very hard. At many times it's very hard, but just be aware of the fact that their connection to you will be strengthened based upon how well you are able to convey that I'm really listening to what you say. And the ultimate expression, not really, it's not an expression of speaking, but the ultimate way that you show that what a person is telling you is something important is being able to listen, what they call listening reflectively, that you're able to verbalize back to them, oh, so what you're saying is that, you know, you're really upset because, you know, your teacher took your paper away today in the middle of the, whatever it is. In other words, you've actually listened to what they've said and you've shown that it's important to them. So that, because despite everything else, you can have the body language, you can have the eye contact, you can, you know, demonstrate non-verbally that you're really listening, but when you can demonstrate that you actually heard what they said, that's the strongest way to get the connection going. In terms of responding to children, so the truth is that probably 98% of how we respond is, or what we respond, it's either we're saying yes or we're saying no. In one form or another, that's what we're doing. We're either saying yes or saying no. The truth is that if we talk about trying to improve our communication, really what we're saying is that we're trying to come up with different ways to be able to say no without it damaging our relationship. Right? Because no is hard to accept. No is hard to hear. But yet we're constantly saying no, right? That's what we're doing. You know, no, you can't. You can't go out and keep playing at supper time. You can't beat up your sister. You can't go to Shloimeh's house now. Or maybe you can never go to Shloimeh's house. You can't wear that skirt. It's too short. You can't stay in bed. You got to get up to school or for shul or for whatever. To go visit grandma, you got to get up. All of those things are no's. You can't keep your underwear on the floor. You got to put it in a hamper. All of the different, we're basically saying no. They want to do something or don't want to do something, and you're saying no. So we have to be able to increase our toolkit and our repertoire of how to say no without it being a turnoff. Now, before we get more into how to say no, just touch upon the fact that many parents have a difficult time saying no, even if we can dress it up and say it in nice other ways. Parents have a hard time exercising or feeling like they're an authority figure. It's a challenge that people have. Like, who am I? Like, I was just a kid, and I, whatever. I'm nobody special. Whatever, all the things that we tell ourselves. So it's important to realize that you're doing your kid the best possible service by having an authority in their life who will set limits for them, will be able to say no to them. It will increase their sense of security, it will increase their self-confidence, and it'll increase the trust that they have in you, because you're somebody who will keep them, you're somebody who's going to keep them safe. You're somebody who's going to keep them in a way that's both physically safe and emotionally safe, because you're a person of authority. So forget about you, forget about us, think about what my child needs, and fake it, you know? Yeah, make believe you're the most important person in the universe. Right? I mean, we do say Bishvili Nivrahalam, right? Hashem created the world just for me. Every person says that. So we're very important, but we have to understand that our child needs for they need to feel that we're the most important and powerful and all knowing person in the world. They're obviously going to, adjust that thinking as they grow older, but certainly when they're younger, they have to have that confidence in their parents. Parent is very wishy-washy and says yes and says no and says yes and no and maybe and they can't make a decision. That's very, very unsettling for a child. When it comes to teachers in a classroom, some teachers have great control and some teachers don't. And one of the main attributes that a teacher who has control in a classroom is that the teacher is convinced for themselves. And they project that when I give an instruction, I'm convinced that you're going to follow it. If you can convince yourself, if you're strong in that feeling, like you convey that, I know you're going to, there's something mystical, magical, whatever it is, that it gets conveyed to the children, and like, oh, we're not messing with this. Not that they're afraid, but like, this is an authority figure. And everybody reacts to an authority figure who's really strong. So, part of being able to help the child, and one of the benefits is also that the children themselves have to learn how to say no. They have to learn to stand up to bullies, they have to stand up to temptation, they have to stand up to, God forbid, to potential predators and other things that, they're going to confront in life. If they never heard a no, so then like they themselves don't, like that's won't be part of their repertoire. So it's very, there's so many areas that it's important to be able to convey to your children that we say no to things. On the flip side, it has to be a no that doesn't ruin our relationship, and that's why we need to have ways of saying it that are not they're not pushing the child away. Part of all this is just keeping in mind, I'm sure you've all heard about the emotional bank account, right? Which is that since saying no is a withdrawal from your emotional bank account, so you always have to try to make deposits. Deposits are when you can give the kids treats, when you can say nice things to them, when you can be helpful to them. All the things that we do, anyway, those are all deposits. If all the kid hears is no, that's going to be, he's going to be in the red. He's going to be, he's going to be bankrupt. But if there's a healthy balance of the positive, then you can present the negatives, and sometimes a no is a very big withdrawal. So you have to have a good balance in your bank account. So you can't just be saying no. Obviously, you have to be making a lot of deposits. Another thing to bear in mind when you're saying no, however nicely we're going to say no, is in the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev, when Yaakov came to the well, and he confronted the shepherds there in Charan, right? So the Yaakov Kamenetsky pointed out that he said, "Achai," he said, "my brothers," and he said, "like that's a strange way to speak to complete strangers. Like he just showed up. He's who's he? He's some guy who just got off the boat, and hi, my brothers." It sounds really weird. So what he explained was that if you're trying to correct somebody else's behavior, you have to have a connection. As he was trying to endear himself to them so that they would be more accepting of the rebuke that he was giving them, which was, you know, why are they not out in the fields, and why are they, you know, why they quit work in the middle of the day by coming to the well. So he was giving them rebuke, therefore the reason to show some endearment. So that's all part of the same idea of making deposits. And the deposits are not limited to the precise communication that you have with the children. It's that your home is one of overall positivity and pleasantness, and it's a nice place to be, and, you know, as much as you know, as much as you can, you reduce the tension. That's why, you know, the shalom bayis between the parents is so critical, because the children, they pick up the whatever turbulence there is. So if there isn't any, or you can minimize it, so it's a calm atmosphere, they feel much more, that just their general well-being is much more settled. So that all of these things set the groundwork for then being able to say no and to guide the children, which is, that's our job. Okay, so let's discuss some techniques, some approaches. Much of what we have a difficulty with is that the kids want something. You know, they want something. They want a candy. They want another dessert. They want to play another 5 minutes. They want to, you know, they want to go out. Whatever it is that they, you know, that they want. They want you to buy them, you know, some kind of a toy, or, you know, they get a little older. It gets, you know, gets bigger. So how do you approach? So the basic approach should be that you empathize with them. It's not, you know, it could be a ridiculous request that they're making, but, you know, to them, it's to the child, it's very meaningful. So you, it's easy, and it doesn't cost us anything to empathize, to say, oh, I see you really want this, you know, Julian, I see, you know, I'm so sorry, we, you know, we're not going to get it now, or, you know, I really wish, you know, we could, you know, the kid, whatever, he wants, you know, wants an ice cream at, you know, 9 o'clock at night or whatever it is. Whatever, I can't, you know, I wish I had wings, I could fly and get it for you and bring it to you, I wish I could. But you're saying no, but you're not shutting down, you know, what they're asking for. You're not showing them that, you know, that you don't respect what they're asking, or you don't respect them. You're respecting them, yeah. I wish I could, if it's something that you wish you could. I mean, some things kids ask and you have to say, you know, that's not for our family, that's not for you, that maybe when you're older, whatever, all of the different answers. But it's got to be that when you have a need to objectively not agree with your child, that you should always be cognizant of the importance of agreeing with the emotion. Don't stifle the emotion. I'm with you. I really wish we could, but, you know, as the adult, you know what you can and you can't do. Kid wants to go on one more ride. You know, I spent, you know, 8 hours at the amusement park. You know, you're falling off your feet, and you know, whatever, you're worried about supper and getting home and traffic, and, you know, that kid wants to go on one more ride. So, you know, say it's ridiculous. You went on 17 rides already today. You say, oh, I see you really want to go on another ride. I wish we could, but it's time that we have to go home. So you're saying the same thing, and you're not, you know, you're not shutting them down, but, you know, they're emotionally, they're being supported, because that's really what they want. They really want it, but you can't provide it. So I wish I could. Yeah.
I was thinking as it was down there speaking. One of the things that I know for myself has something to do with if I'm having a hard time understanding why they're so disappointed about something, like in the amusement park example. So I like try to find an example for myself that I would feel disappointed about, even if, for example, I had a lot of the item, but I still want more of it. So if I can just, you know, quickly think of something for myself, firstly, it helps me feel the emotion of empathizing with them, and also I can even convey it to the kid. Like, I know what that feels like. There was a time that I also had something that I really wanted more of, and I just couldn't have it. And I get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kids, they certainly appreciate not just the emotion, but, you know, that, like, you're speaking on their, you know, to their, on their level, so to speak. You're personalizing it, and you're, yeah, that's great. Yeah, very good. Thank you. Okay. Now, similarly, what happens when they mess up? Whatever they, you know, the kid went over, whatever, he was careless, and they whatever knocked over, I don't know, half the books on your bookshelf come flying on the floor, or whatever. So, you can react by, with your emotion, like, who knows how many books, you know, got their you know, the binding got ruined, and this is a mess, and how many are we going to clean this up? And, you know, you can be thinking about that and be really upset with the kid and start lashing out with them, and you're so careless, I told you 10 times not to play ball in the living room or whatever it is. Or you can focus on fixing the problem. Okay. There's books all over the floor. Okay. They need to be cleaned up. And obviously the perpetrator should be at the head of the line of those who are cleaning up. Others can help, but focus on fixing. Try not to vent your frustration with the child. Okay, that's what a spouse and friends are for. But try to not, don't use your children as your sounding board. What's the situation now? The situation now is the kid messed up. I can assure you that if it's a big mess up that they know that the parent's not happy about, they're gonna feel bad. So the last thing they need is for you now to go and tell them, you know, and start berating them and giving them, you know, what for. They realize, you know, they messed up. I just use a quick example. It's an extreme example. Many years ago, we had an incident in the playground where we have a rule: you can't pick up stones, you know, rocks. You certainly can't throw them, but you can't even pick them up because once you have a rock in a kid's hand, it's, you know, what are they going to do with it? Anyway, so there was a situation where a kid, he was nobody around. He, you know, threw the stone like who knows where, and of course there was some kid who was running, hit him in the eye. He ended up in the hospital. So, like, everybody wanted to know for how many years I was going to suspend this kid for throwing the rock. So, did not do anything. I mean, he had the child, you know, visit the other child in the hospital and buy him gifts. I heard that the mother was, you know, guilt was beyond. But there was really no need to do anything. What was I going to add to the child's lesson? That child, I'm sure, never threw a rock again anywhere near people because he got the best lesson that he could possibly have gotten. You know, whatever we throw on top of it, it's not meaningful. So, you have to realize that when kids, you know, they mess up, they feel bad already. So focus on fixing the problem. Don't focus on your frustration on it. Obviously, you're frustrated. You have to try to stifle that, especially since the child will pick up on the emotion of your reaction, which will then teach them what the value of whatever it was that they did. Yeah.
What happens if the child doesn't want to cooperate with you on fixing the problem?
Okay. That's a very legitimate question, and it happens all the time. What if the child doesn't want to cooperate? So you say twice, maximum 3 times, you know, this need to be fixed up. And then depending upon the situation, you can say something like, I see that you know, you're not ready to be a helper, or maybe you need to be bigger in order to do this job. Show them that without disrespecting them, but, you know, show them that they're okay, you're not ready to do it yet. Not that, you know, I'm angry with you for it. I may be a little disappointed that you can convey, but okay, so you're not ready to do it. But don't get into confrontations, you know, power struggles in general, you know, when you win the power struggle, you lose the war, because what you're teaching a child in a power struggle is that you're bigger and you're stronger, and therefore, who wins? The person who's bigger and stronger wins. So when they're bigger and stronger than you, they're going to win, you know, against you, and that's going to be, you know, that's going to be another thought in their mind, you know, in their subconscious as they grow up, that, you know, the way you get things is that you know, you got to be stronger than other people. You know, so that's not a good message. You want
and eventually it will severe the bond between the child and the parent.
Right, that's all. That certainly doesn't help. I mean, the bond is very strong, so don't worry. You know, we can mess up 1,000 times and we still have a bond. So, we're talking in a perfect world. None of us are perfect, and children's, the connection is very, very resilient. You can always fix it up even after years of messing up. But power struggle is just not, you win for the moment. You force the kid to do it. But if you really reflect on, what you were thinking at the time, think back to the last power struggle, which might have been 45 minutes ago, but if you think back, your emotions were basically, you were very upset. So you were upset, so you just had to get your way. And that's normal, and don't beat yourself up for it. We do it, all of us are guilty of that, but that's really what's going on. So you tell them, you repeat the instruction, and then you step back. It's not the end of the world if you can't deal with it. Yeah.
So should you fix the problem for them in front of them? Mm-hmm.
Well, again, it's a very delicate balance, because you don't want them to feel, like they're no good. But you want to show them that, yes, and that, if you're not cleaning it up, so I guess, mommy's going to have to clean it up, however you want to say it, it's very easy to, knock them down, you're such a baby, or you don't want to say that, when you're bigger, then you'll be able to help out. I started mentioning that, depending upon your emotional reaction to whatever they did wrong, that will convey the message of how important something is. So you should keep in mind that if it's something that is a character flaw, then you do have to show strong emotion. If you catch a child in a lie, then don't embarrass them, not in public, but privately, you just convey, how hurtful it is, and how terrible it is that my child is telling a lie, it breaks my heart that something like that could happen in our family, that somebody would not be truthful, and that they need to hear that emotion, that when they knock over your lamp and they break it, and you're that's usually where you get all the shrieking and the yelling and the hollering, because we're it's our favorite lamp, we're very upset. But that conveys that the lamp is more important than telling the truth. So you want to, when you use, we are ultimately, we're in control of our emotions, as much as that takes a lifetime of work to be able to get there. But we realize that we're sending messages with, with the emotion that we're conveying.
Can I just?
Yeah.
Just curious your opinion on this approach that I often do. Like over the age of 5, I'd say probably if my 7-year-old did something where he spilled something, I'll say something like, if he's not ready, because I see he's just emotionally worked up and I'm telling him to clean it up, I'll say okay, well, nothing's gonna happen though until this is done. Obviously dinner, I'm not gonna deprive him of dinner, but something like, oh, I wanna go outside and play, I'll say, okay, just as soon as you clean that up. And then he oftentimes will clean it up to do that. Younger though, I find if I ask them 5, 4, do you need help? They usually say yeah. And then if I help them.
But that's great, because you're helping them.
Right.
It's their responsibility to clean up the mess. You can always offer help. That's
right. Oftentimes you're just overwhelmed by the task. And if I just help them clean up.
Oh, for sure. Right.
But the other approach, we're older, nothing will happen. I won't take away a story, reading. I won't take away, obviously, food or snacks, but if they're hungry, but I will take away an activity they want to do until that's done.
Right, assuming that it was something that they're capable of. In other words,
if
you're allowing a 2-year-old insists on pouring their own milk, so 10 times out of 10, it's going to be all over the place.
Right.
So that would not be a responsibility you would want to give them. But if it's reasonable to expect that they might be successful at it, and then they're not, so then, okay, very matter-of-factly, okay, now we have to clean up before we move on to anything else. So that's great. Right. Very good. Okay. similarly, when a child does something wrong, the first thing, knocking the books over is probably an accident. But let's say you have a child who's scribbling on the wall. Okay, so again, depends on the age. Really, at any age, rather than saying, you know, how dare you, and I told you 1,000 times not to, and you know, you're not going to be able to use crayons till you're 15, all those things, you just say, walls are not for scribbling. Let's clean it up. As you just let them know. I mean, they're going to realize that, like, oops, because they probably impulsively just did whatever they did. And focus again on the action that has to be done at that time, rather than all of your emotions. Okay? Walls are not for scribbling. Whatever, little sisters are not for banging on the head. However you want to say it. And let's fix the situation. And also just a technique that we use in the classroom all the time in order to get kids to do things is rather than, don't be overly lavish in praise because that sounds a little bit, you know, artificial to children. But you could say, you know, like let's say you have a nice-sized family and you're trying to get them to come to supper, rather than yelling at the kids who are not at supper yet or expressing frustration, you say, I noticed 2 of the children are at the table, and you know you have verbally expressed, you know, your